5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Flight cleared for takeoff.
Hello and welcome to Kentucky Caliber. My name's Jason Belcher. I'm your host. This week, wanted to focus on two things. They're not really related, but they're the only thing they really share is that they both have sort of happened in the past week. The first one is Hurricane Helen, and the second one is the escalating conflict in the Middle East. But I want to start with the hurricane first. And the reason I wanted to start with that one is because it hits so close to home. For those of us that live here in Eastern Kentucky, if you look at the map of the path that the storm took after it made landfall. So it came from the Gulf of Mexico, made landfall at the Big Bend of Florida, and then continued inland north up towards Asheville, North Carolina. And it swung west at the last moment and sort of curved out towards the western part of Tennessee and then western Kentucky, where it hung around for a while, dropping a lot more rain. But if you look at that map, there's a point there where it was actually headed right for us. And just at the last minute there, it turned west. Otherwise, it's quite possible and even likely that the area I live in here in eastern Kentucky would have seen effects similar to what happened in eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina, especially in the Asheville area. So we dodged a bullet here. We don't normally think of ourselves as in, because we're so far inland, we're several hundred miles from, and you get to drive all day to get down to the coast of Florida. So for those of us up here, it's not something we usually think about. Like, we watch storms that hit because, you know, we have family members or loved ones that are in affected areas. But when it comes to our own town or our own homes being affected by hurricanes, it's not something that we spend much time thinking about. This one easily could have. So I wanted to just talk briefly about the storm itself. And then more significantly, I think the response that has happened in the wake of the storm, rather the response to many of the disasters that have happened. The first thing I just wanted to talk about briefly is what made this storm so devastating for the southeastern United States. Why we've seen there's lots of hurricanes. I mean, I was stationed in the panhandle of Florida back in the late 90s, and Hurricane George actually hit while I was there. And I remember at the time, the base where I was at, the base asked for volunteers to stay in some of the aircraft hangars where I was doing my training. And they specifically were looking for folks who were single. At the time, I was not married and didn't have any kids yet. Well, I didn't get married until 2000. I didn't have my oldest son wasn't born until 2004. So at that time, I think it was 98, I was still single and didn't have any kids. So I volunteered. And I stayed in the aircraft hangar. I was one of the overnight crew that was in there as the storm actually hit. And I remember I got a call from the Pentagon, this Fulbright colonel, who's asking about wanted to know the status of the aircraft that we had there. And so I told him, well, sir, the aircraft are secure. And I could sort of tell from the fact that I was a second lieutenant and he was a colonel, this guy was, he said, well, how do you know that, Lieutenant? You know, he sounded pretty skeptical, and I don't blame him. Looking back on it now, I can understand why he felt that way. But my response was, because I'm in the hangar with him, sir. And after that, there was sort of a pause on the other end of the line, and he just goes, oh, well, good job. Then he hung up. That's all I remember from that. We were fortunate. The damage was nominal. There wasn't a lot. There was some minor structural damage, but none of the aircraft during that hurricane were hit. And we had trees down and some power outages, but it was nothing serious. So we dodged a bullet. But I remember just hearing the winds roar out there for that long. And I kept thinking to myself, I can't believe that nature can do this. Like, how I've never experienced anything like this. Like, how does this happen? Because I'd never been through a hurricane before. And for folks who have been through many can tell you that's exactly how it goes. Nature absolutely can do that. And as it demonstrated last week with Hurricane Helen, it can do so with a vengeance, and it caused a lot of destruction, not only along the coast of the panhandle there, Florida, where it came ashore, but also inland. In fact, the inland portions were even worse, and there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, one of the reasons for that was this storm was very fast moving, and there was a couple of low pressure fronts that had formed on either side of the storm that really just helped kind of slingshot it through its landfall and kept it moving at a much faster pace than than storms normally do. Like normally, when we see these things, they come ashore and then they slow down and they just hang around and inundate the areas right near the coast where they first make landfall. Then they kind of break up and remnants of it sort of drift inland after that. That's what we normally see. But this storm was moving so fast that it kept much of its energy and much of its moisture intact after landfall. And so it still was carrying all of its water after it passed the panhandle, after it passed the beach, and it carried all of that inland towards the southeastern United States. And when it got to the Appalachian Mountains, there's a thing meteorologists call the upslope effect. And what that is, what happens is when the clouds that are carrying all that moisture run into the mountains and they get pushed upwards at, and they're moving really fast, as they were in this case, the force from that squeezes out the moisture. So it rains harder and the volume of rainfall happens much faster, right? So more rain falls in a shorter amount of time, producing, you know, devastating floods for affected areas, which is exactly what happened this time. So as it, as this storm or what was left of it over the southeastern U.S. collided with the Appalachian Mountains, the upslope effect helped it produce huge amounts of rainfall in a very short time. And unfortunately, when that amount of water falls into a steep topography like the Appalachian Mountains, the water always flows downward into the valley. So, you know, if those of us who live in eastern Kentucky, we have a lot of very sharp, narrow valleys. And it's the same throughout the Appalachian mountain chain, especially south of us. So all that water had nowhere to go except through the valleys. It follows gravity. And that is why there was such a huge amount of water surging down through a lot of small towns and even larger towns like Asheville, which was absolutely devastated. Those things all just, all those factors sort of just came together and allowed it to inundate, instead of the coastal regions, the areas further inland, like western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, and of course parts of Georgia and Florida as well. And so those things, and when it hits areas that aren't used to it, their capacity to respond is not quite as robust as those near the coast. But that's where I wanted to pivot for just a little bit and talk about the response to the storm, because that's something I think that has been, if there is a silver lining in this disaster, which I know has just destroyed many people's homes and businesses and upended their lives, and it's going to take months, if not years, for some of those places to fully recover. But if there is a silver lining in this, it has been the response of disaster and relief organizations. There's a lot of them out there. The Cajun Navy is a good example. I know they've done a lot of swift boat rescues to folks who were trapped by rapidly moving waters. And I think that's another important point. Some of these things, you know, you look at it and you go, well, how could that happen? Well, the water came out, it came fast. Like the rising waters that hit these towns and hit some people's homes just hit in a rapid amount of time. There was no time for them to evacuate. It just hit really fast. Another organization that I wanted to highlight, because I'm a member of it. So, you know, full disclosure, right? I've got personal bias on this one. I've been a member of Team Rubicon since, oh, I think 2000, I can't remember if it was 2016 or 2017. I'm not sure. Anyway, so for 7 or 8 years, I've been a member. I've done two deployments with them. One here locally when the floods hit eastern Kentucky in 2022, I went over to Whitesburg and helped them do some cleanup for homes that had been affected. And then prior to that, I think the other one I did was in Pigeon Forge for the wildfires that hit near there to do cleanup after that. I'm sure there's going to be opportunities, many, to deploy. We call it deployment with Team Rubicon. It, what the organization is, it's a veteran-led disaster relief and aid organization that brings in supplies, does cleanup effort, and does debris removal, which includes route clearing. So they free up roads that have been blocked, which they've been doing with this one, with this hurricane. And I'm not sure what year they were. I have to look up, see what year Team Rubicon was found. We've been around for a while now, so over a decade. And we've grown a lot in the last few years. And to illustrate that, I just wanted to share briefly with you some of the stats that, that Team Rubicon has already done. So within the first 2 days of the storms hitting, Team Rubicon already had served 35 communities across 4 states. Over 140 volunteers had deployed, including 5 recon teams. They had collectively moved over 6,500 cubic yards of material that was blocking roadways. That's 400 dump trucks worth in 3 days. They moved all that debris in Georgia, Tennessee, and South Carolina, and now I know also in Western North Carolina. If you think about it, I mean, that's pretty amazing. Like, for a private organization, it's a nonprofit that relies on donations and volunteers. It's pretty amazing. I mean, that's a government-like capability that a private organization can move into regions that have been affected. And one of the great things about Team Rubicon is, you know, we work with government organizations, but we have the speed advantage. We can move faster than government or agencies can sometimes. It's called speed to need. That's one of the philosophies of the organization. We get material or help that's needed where it's needed quickly. So that's what speed to need means. And they've been doing it so far in the response to Hurricane Helen. The way it works is, so those of us that are members, we have to go through deployment training, which includes we have some courses we have to complete. We have a medical evaluation and make sure we're not, you know, we're fully healthy and able to handle stressful, you know, physical demands. Once we're certified deployment ready, we input our information and the team will send us out a message saying, hey, can you volunteer to whatever, we're going to do an operation in whatever town, whatever state at this time and date, can you be there? And if you say yes, you just answer the text message and then you show up and stay for as long as you can and do the work, which includes muck removal, debris removal. You know, a lot of times people whose homes are affected by those things either have to move it themselves or they have to pay contractors to bring in equipment, which can be pretty expensive for folks who are already in a bad situation, right? Can't afford to do that. And so that's one of the great things about Team Rubicon is we do it for free. So we come in and we help them and we remove debris and we clean up. And we provide that service to folks who have been stricken by disaster at no cost to them. And so that's terrific. We also have some pretty strict rules when we're out there. And I learned this when I did my first deployment with them. We also have some pretty strict rules about how we conduct ourselves as professionals, since we're almost all military veterans. One of the things we do not do is we do not allow members who are doing deployments or cleanup to take pictures of themselves or people's homes or businesses that have been affected. So no disaster selfies that you can share on social media. So you won't see that. You won't see members of Team Rubicon sharing pictures of themselves doing cleanup, because our thinking is that would really be, you know, hurtful to the people who've lost their homes. They don't want people looking at their home that's been destroyed or their property that's been damaged or whatever it is they've been lost. We want to keep that private to them. So we do not do that. Well, we respect their privacy and we don't take disaster selfies. We just go to render assistance and that is all. And if, you know, if the news shows up and takes pictures of us, that's another story. I mean, we can't control that. If the owners themselves of homes or businesses take pictures of us, you know, that's their choice. We're fine with that. That's okay. That's just that, but that's not something our organization can control. So anyway, I've been really impressed so far just with the early response of Team Rubicon, and you can expect that to grow. I mean, we actually do operations all across the world. We're a global organization, but I think you'll see the numbers that we've already done just in the first 3 days will vastly be increased as more people are able to go. You know, the way it works is you got to do that route clearance first. I mean, in some cases, we have to get permission from the local authorities and first responders before we can even go in there, because the last thing we want to do is create more problems for first responders. So once we get permission from local authorities to go in and start doing assistance, then we can do that. So some of the most severely hit areas, which take longer to clear the routes and longer to get that permission, it'll take us longer to get there simply because you weren't able to reach it. We do have an airborne capability. We do have a boat capability, but those are fairly limited. And so once the roads, at least some road access, is restored to affected communities, that's when you'll see the bulk of agencies and organizations like ours really start to increase the volume of aid and supplies that they can bring to people. And I know it's frustrating for people whose communities, towns, and homes have been affected by this. And I know there's been a lot of relief effort already, but I know there's also been frustration from some folks, like, why aren't they here? How come this place hasn't been helped yet? How come that place hasn't been helped yet? Well, the reason for that almost always is we can't get there yet. And so the disaster is so severe that there's no access, and it's really difficult to move a high volume of supplies by air or by boat to those communities. So most of the time, till we get those roads cleared, which is happening now, and we're part of that, and so are many other organizations. So just think about how remarkable it is that we have organizations like that, fully volunteered and nonprofits that are out there moving faster than the government can, and working in concert with the government to provide people with relief and aid and to help them start the rebuilding and recovery process after a major disaster like that. You know, people have called the North Carolina flood biblical. I mean, if you think about biblical times, you know, 2,000 years ago or more, when disaster struck, everybody was on your own, right? It was just everybody for themselves. Like, communities were cut off. They couldn't even tell the outside world what had happened because there was no way to communicate with them. And there were certainly no governments or private organizations around to help them. So they were on their own. So if you contrast that today, it's sort of comforting to know that there is help out there and that help will come for you or come to help you if disaster strikes. I know that we seem to be experiencing more natural disasters more frequently and more intense, but the silver lining is our capacity to respond to them has also increased. And Team Rubicon is a certainly not the only one, but a shining example of that. The second thing that I wanted to cover or talk about today was the escalating conflict in the Middle East. And we've been keeping an eye on that for quite some time, not just because my son is a Marine. So everyone who has loved ones in the military knows that the potential exists for them to be forward deployed to an area that could be involved in direct combat or direct combat operations. I know recently the 101st Airborne is scheduled to rotate forward to CENTCOM, which is Central Command. I'm not sure exactly where in CENTCOM they're going, but that's somewhere in the Middle East. And they've been planning that. I think it's a 9-month rotation. They've been planning that for some time. I've seen folks online say, hey, why are we sending, you know, the 101st Airborne to the Middle East? Why can't we send them to the southeastern United States? They're more needed here. Well, it's not that simple. The 101st Airborne is an air assault organization. That's what they do. That's what they train for. That's what they're equipped to do. That's what they're good at. That's what they're effective at. They are not a disaster relief organization. I know everyone, it seems like whenever a disaster strikes, of course the military has helped in this case. I think about 6,000 National Guardsmen from over 5 states have already been conducting hundreds of rescues in affected areas for Hurricane Helen. So there has been a response from the military. But in the case of the 101st, you know, they're heading to the Middle East because that's where they've been training to go, and that's what they're prepared for. It's not as simple as just turning it off and turning them back around. That's just not how it works. As for the situation itself, it's increased significantly just in the past week with the Israeli ground incursion into Lebanon. I remember the last time that happened. This isn't the first time the Israel ground forces have gone into Lebanon. The last time was 2006, and I believe, if I have my dates right, that was happening during or right before my deployment to Iraq. So I was in that part of the world in 2006. And we had some pretty good intel on what was happening down there, which was a little bit to the west of where we were in Iraq. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, one of these days, if Israel goes to war with Iran, which was the big concern then as now, and I kept thinking to myself, you know, we were operating one of the largest runways in the air base I was at was a huge air base. And at one point during combat operations, we actually surpassed Heathrow. London's Heathrow for numbers of takeoffs and landings per day at an airfield. So it was a very big, busy, very capable airfield. And I thought, man, if I ever look out there and see an Israeli jet flying out of our runway towards Iran, I might as well just call home and say, I ain't going to be home for like at least a year and probably more. Cause it's going to get an already bad situation. It's going to get about to get a whole lot worse. If Israel goes to war directly with Iran, which essentially is the de facto state we have now. So technically, I think there is a state of war between Israel and Iran. Neither one has issued a declaration. Like, the Iranian government hasn't issued a declaration. The Israeli government hasn't issued a declaration, but they've traded fire already. Their proxies have traded fire in Lebanon. This last attack, which the Pentagon reports about 200 missiles that were fired from Iran towards Israel, most of those were shot down, not all of them. And Most of those are ballistic missiles, meaning they're surface to surface. Some of the Iranian missiles that they use are substantially bigger than what we've seen in the past. They carry quite a punch. Some of them carry up to a 4,000-pound warhead. That's a significant amount of explosives. That can do a lot of damage, especially in an urban environment or to a military base. So this was a serious attack. And the defensive systems, the Israeli missile defense systems, along with the American, and I think some of the British too, anti-missile capabilities, were able to knock most of them down. So this happened, I think, back in April, when almost all of the Iranian missiles were knocked down. This time, a few got through. And I hope folks realize that's not a failure of their missile defense systems. They're not, nothing's 100%. It never will be. I've seen those things work. I was standing underneath one of the missile perimeter defense systems work when I was deployed. And that was back in 2006 when these things were brand new. And the technology at that time was super classified. It's, of course, been, you know, there's a lot more that you can read about it now in the open source. Back then, I couldn't tell anybody that I'd seen it. I remember coming home thinking if I told them, no one would believe me anyway. But what the version we had was a 20-millimeter cannon, a series of them that were posted around. They were taken right off of some of the Navy ships, and they were posted on points around the perimeter. There were several of them, and they're linked to a radar system. And what happens is the radar system is through an automated response, happens in nanoseconds. The radar will detect an incoming projectile and immediately assess and target the 20-millimeter cannon, closest one, to fire at that projectile, destroying it in flight. So we knock it down with incoming rounds. Some of those are explosive rounds. And so at night, it's an amazing, I mean, it looks like a fireworks show gone insane, although a deadly one, because those things are not just fireworks. When they land, you know, they cause destruction. And so I've seen it fire. I watched it fire right in front of me and a couple of times right beside me. And I saw it hit the incoming projectiles, and it just a bunch of colors burst in the air, and you can see the fragments landing back to the ground. But it was an effective system even then. And so the technology has gotten a lot better, and the Israeli systems are way ahead of what we had in 2006. They have a layered defense. They have missile interceptors. They have cannon interceptors. They have a combination of different types of technology that they employ to knock down the incoming Iranian missiles. And so it's very effective. It was this time, too, even though it didn't stop all of them. The larger question is, what will Israel do now? So they're already fighting a ground war in Lebanon. They say it's limited, but you know, war has a tendency to defy those kind of guardrails and just spiral out of control. I'm not saying that will happen, but it could. The reason that they decided to go into southern Lebanon is because Hezbollah has stationed thousands and probably tens of thousands of rockets and missiles that they routinely shoot at Israeli cities indiscriminately, by the way. Hezbollah doesn't bother targeting military installations. They just fire them at Israel. It's pretty indiscriminate. And so there is a specific military purpose for the Israeli ground incursion into Lebanon, and destroying Hezbollah's missile capability is number one on that list. Hezbollah itself has been significantly disrupted and degraded by Israeli precision strikes. They killed Hassan Nasrallah, who was the head of the Hezbollah movement in Lebanon, and many of their other, you know, more junior commanders have been killed as well. So I would say that organization has been significantly disrupted. And what does that mean? Well, here's the big picture, I think. Hezbollah is one of those organizations that has several missions. Does it provide food and supplies and education to civilians in Lebanon? It does that, but it primarily exists to prepare, train, and attack Israel. That's their stated objective, is the destruction of Israel. They train for it, they equip for it, and they attack Israel at times of their choosing for reasons that are not entirely clear to me. I don't know why they pick certain days and certain targets, but they do. And so Israel has certainly a right of self-defense to remove that threat from its border, and that's what they're doing. The government of Lebanon is, at this point, is essentially a failed state. The government there really has almost no authority or power. Hezbollah does. And so Hezbollah essentially runs certain parts of the country. I know that the people in Lebanon are divided about that. Some support Hezbollah, some are are very much opposed to them. And so when Israel issued a statement the other day saying this is, they have a chance to redraw the face redraw the landscape of the Middle East, that's true. They do. And I hope one of the outcomes from that is that Lebanon bans or pushes Hezbollah out of its country. Because as one of their ministers the leaders of one of the local churches in Lebanon correctly pointed out, and I had his name here and I can't find it, but what he said was more important. Hezbollah has created a culture of death, which tells people about imaginary victories, but has inflicted real defeat and humiliations on the people. And the operation that you're watching happen right now is one of those. That's what he's talking about. They tell people that they're invincible and they can't be harmed if they join Hezbollah, that they're fighters of God and nothing could happen to them. Well, as we've seen, that's completely false. The Israeli military has very much a capability to fight them and has been doing so effectively. They learned a lot of lessons from 2006. That's another dimension to this conflict I wanted to briefly touch on. Surprise. So even though these are old adversaries who know each other, who've known each other a long time and have been fighting for a long time, they still surprise each other. And that happened in 2006 when the last time Israel went into Lebanon on the ground, and it was both ways. The Israelis were surprised that Hezbollah was so well armed and well trained. The Hezbollah fighters had anti-tank weapons, and they knew how to use them, and they were very effective against Israeli armor and their mechanized carriers, and so they inflicted a lot more damage on Israel than Israel expected. Well, Hezbollah was surprised that Israel was even there. What triggered that particular battle, that round of conflict, was the capture or kidnapping of an Israeli soldier by Hezbollah. Well, they thought one guy is not going to cause this much of a trouble, and they even admitted this. At the time, Nasrallah even said, hey, we were surprised. We didn't think Israel would respond this forcefully to the abduction of one soldier. And so what you see from that is even enemies that have known each other for a long time still make miscalculations. And I think this is another example. What we're seeing today play out in the Middle East, what started this, the Hamas attack on Israel in October of 2023, was yet another in an endless series of miscalculations. I don't know what Hamas actually thought would happen when they attacked Israel in October of 2023, but I think it's pretty clear they did not expect this level of response from the Israeli government and from the Israeli military. So that's yet another example of miscalculations on all sides. The big question now is, will Israel respond to the Iranian attack by attacking Iran directly? Thus far, they've not done that. Thus far, the attacks have been confined to Hamas, which is an Israeli proxy, Iranian proxy, excuse me, or Hezbollah, another Iranian proxy. In addition to that, a lot of action has been going on in Yemen with the Houthi. The Houthi they receive a lot of training and supplies from Iran as well, and they've been using that to attack shipping and to try to fire missiles at Israel, which is a long way away. The U.S. military, by the way, has been engaged in some pretty hefty operations in there. The last carrier strike group that was there for several months, these are their numbers, not mine. They acknowledged firing over 800 missiles or projectiles at Houthi targets, in addition to several rounds of airstrikes. So I think we've carried out over 1,000 attacks against Houthi targets. That's a lot. That's a lot of iron to be dropping. So that threat, although it's that seems to be working, there hasn't been nearly as many attacks on shipping. There hasn't been any more Houthis firing missiles at Israel. That's probably because the U.S. Navy wiped them out, and the British Navy also. They've been involved too, but mostly the United States has wiped out those targets. So what's the big picture right now from all this? I think Iran has been weakened by this. I think Iran is the loser in this, and here's why. Their proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthi, the Iranians have continually told them that if there's ever a battle with Israel, this major army is going to come from Iran and destroy their enemies. Well, it didn't happen. It didn't happen at all. Why the Israeli Defense Forces have been destroying Hamas and annihilating Hezbollah, which they are, by the way, And while we've been destroying the Houthi, Iran's been sitting on the sidelines with their hands in their pockets, not doing a thing. The missile attacks are serious. I don't mean to downplay that at all. But to their allies or to their proxies, they've been exposed as a paper tiger. They were promised all these martyrs and all this military assistance and all this help, and they didn't get it. So Israel is cleaning their clock right now, and Iran right now is the clear loser. That doesn't mean it'll stay that way. Okay, what the Iranians are going to do in the future is anybody's guess. But as of today, right now, they've certainly been weakened by the Israeli response. And a large measure of that is due to the actions of the U.S. military and the Biden administration. I think the Biden administration has done more for Israel than any other U.S. president in American history. And that's probably more of a political problem for the left and the Democrats than it is for the conservatives on the right and Republicans who generally support strong measures to help Israel. But you can't say that the Biden administration hasn't helped Israel. They've helped Israel more than any other presidency because we are actively carrying out sustained weeks and months long combat operations directly on Israel's behalf. And that is at the order of Joe Biden. So there's no way anybody can tell you that the Biden administration has not helped Israel. The public spats, the arguments back and forth between him and Netanyahu, okay, that's significant, but it's far less significant than the actual actions carried out by the U.S. military on Israel's behalf. What I expect to see in the future, I expect the Israel ground incursion for Lebanon to last at least several weeks because there's so much there that Hezbollah has stationed. It's going to take a long time, even on the ground, to clear all of that out. I expect that to continue. When Iran attacked Israel last time, Israel refrained from a large response against Iran itself. This time, I think they will. I could be wrong, but I think this time they will, because the major mechanisms by which Iran could respond to Israel, their militias, Hamas and Hezbollah, have been greatly damaged by the Israeli military. The Israeli military, in terms of military success, is winning this conflict right now. Whether that leads to an ultimate political solution or victory is a completely separate argument. I totally acknowledge that. And I'll get into that at a separate time. I'm just talking military today, not the political dimensions. But right now, the Israeli military and the U.S. military are winning, and Iran is the clear loser, and they look weak. They look weak not to us. They look weak to their allies. And I think their allies now are going to start asking themselves, why are we, you know, They claim to have unshakable faith, but I think it's been shaken. And I think the reason it's been shaken is the Iranian response, or rather lack thereof, to the Israeli military success. I don't personally want to see a further escalation of hostilities in the Middle East. I don't want to see the U.S. military drawn into another conflict in the Middle East. Getting out of there and how we would do that, it's going to take more than just someone saying, well, we shouldn't be there. It's going to take a specific plan of action and specific reasons for that. And that's a whole separate, another discussion, which I'd love to do at another time, but we're already hitting the 30-minute mark, which is about where I wanted to stay today. So those are the Hurricane Helen and the escalating conflict in the Middle East is the two things that I wanted to cover today, just briefly, and to emphasize some of the things that I see as important and significant with both of those two developments. So, hey, I really appreciate you taking the time to listen, and I hope you have a great day. Thanks.